Antonia, do you know whose voice this is?
No.
Okay. I kind of half expected you to say yes. So, actually, that woman is Ema Sumac.
Well, I do know who Ema Sumac is, but you can't just play them like three notes and I'm like some sort of like amazing savant that's like, ah, yes, the three notes of Ema Sumac.
How did I forget that you weren't a musical genius?
True. She was really popular in the 50s, right?
Yeah. Ema Sumac was known as the Queen of Exotica and an Inca princess. And like you said, she was a big deal in the 1950s. But actually, her career lasted decades.
When I went to go listen to her, I was like, oh my gosh. I would never in a million years would ever be able to sing all those notes that she sang.
This is Gabriela Reyes, a Nicaraguan-American soprano in the Lindenman Young Artist Development Program at the Metropolitan Opera. Ema could sing a 4-octave, almost 5-octave range, which is why it's hard to classify her into any of the traditional singing classifications. An average soprano can sing maybe 3 octaves.
What was really, I think, eye-catching for me when, or ear-catching, I should say, is when I heard her, like, the range that she has, she sings bass notes, notes that the lowest category of male voice. She sang those notes.
That's a voice? That sounds like a... That's wild.
As well as way beyond the highest category of voice.
That's insane.
Yeah.
She presented something very unusual.
This is Nick Lemansky. He wrote a book on Ema Sumac's life.
Because you have to understand that a lot of the things that she did on record, nobody had ever heard anybody do before. In Variety, they printed this big advertisement about Ema saying that she had sung in 47 states of America, 40 cities in Russia, 24 cities.
People were drawn to her. She played in cities all over the world. And at every airport, she was received like royalty.
So we're talking about a woman who, like, was famous. Technically, back then, she was more famous, I think, than somebody like Beyoncé.
Okay, I mean, I refuse to believe that she was more famous than Beyoncé.
Well, you can decide for yourself in the end, but she's the only Peruvian woman to have a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, she was in movies. But at the same time, in her homeland, she was accused of exploiting her indigenous roots. For decades, this Inca princess would cast a spell with her mystical voice. But the one place this Peruvian beauty couldn't put a spell on was her place of birth, Peru.
From NPR and Futura Media, I'm Antonia Cereijido. And today, The Breakdown, The Spell of Ema Sumac. All right, so I'm here with producer Jeannie Montalvo.
Hey, Anto. Today, we're talking about one of the original divas, Ema Sumac.
Ever since this Latin beauty set foot on American soil, Ema Sumac and her golden voice have been electrifying the airwaves.
Part of her lure, besides the extraordinary voice, was that it came out of a beautiful, beautiful woman. That has everything to do with this.
This is Damon Devine. He was her personal assistant, makeup artist, friend, and he was her caretaker throughout the last decade of her life.
She had upward slanted green eyes, which I suppose you would consider exotic. And the famous Ema eyeliner would exaggerate that. The full mouth, the patent leather looking black hair, the bone structure. That, with the voice, was said to have put a spell on people.
Okay, so she had these green eyes.
Yeah.
And was called exotic, but
she had a lot of European features.
I was just enchanted immediately. I think people thought maybe I made that up, but it's a real thing. And I've seen it many, many times since me.
Ema was known for her lavish outfits, wearing amazing jewels and extravagant gowns and her indigenous-style accessories and headdresses.
Our first guest for this evening, Miss Ema Sumac.
The height of her career was in the 50s and into the early 60s.
You have one of the most exciting voices I've ever heard.
Thank you, that is very kind.
But she was popular for so much longer. Later on, Damon says she struggled.
She had driven away lots of people in her social circle. and her professional circle. So she was, you know, quite isolated in her own way.
While she rose to prominence across the globe, she was dealing with all these challenges in her life, including this backlash that she dealt with from Peru. But let's start at the beginning. Hey, yep.
My name in Spanish, Zoila Augusta Emperatriz. And the Ima Suma is my name too, but in Peruvian name, in Peruvian language, which means a beautiful flower, a beautiful girl, they say, you know. And I was born in Peru 2,000 years ago, but I'm still young.
That's Ima Sumac in a French TV documentary in 1993. When she says Peruvian language, she means Quechua, an indigenous language spoken in the Andes.
When I was a little girl, I lived upon the mountains in Peru. I used to imitate the birds. That is how I began singing.
Is that something that she was born with? Could anybody train to have that sort of like note range? Like, how did she even achieve that?
She was self-taught.
I never had a teacher in my life because the way I sing, I think no one can teach me the way I sing.
That's Ima from an interview in 1984. She was born in Ichocan, which is part of the Cajamarca region in the Andes. But she also grew up in Lima. And she's the baby of six children.
My parents were very strict, especially my mother. I told my parents that I want to be a singer. Oh, my mother was terrible, upset, very angry. She said, no, never, 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 never.
She adopts her stage name, Ima Sumac, because her parents weren't too into the idea of her singing.
The only person who knew that I was singing was my older sisters. So one day, my family was in the living room, listening to the radio. Then I start singing. So my sister asked me, "Say, mommy, mother, do you know who she is?" And my mother said, "No, no, but she seemed beautiful, very nice." And father, "Do you know who is she singing?" "No, but she seemed beautiful." My sister, "Do you know who is she?" "Ima." So my mom, "What?"
She joins a folkloric music group in 1942. Whose director, Moises Vivanco, later that year becomes her husband. During the next 4 years, the group blows up all over Latin America. At this moment in time, she's doing strictly folkloric music, and that is what propels them to fame. They played in both Mexico and Argentina, which are considered the two meccas of the entertainment industry. If you were anyone, you performed there. And so, having reached the top in Latin America, Ima and her husband Moises formed a trio and decided to move from Peru to New York City in 1946. The Inca Taqui trio is composed of Ima Sumac, Yola, or Cholita Rivera, plus Moises Vivanco. But they're met with a lukewarm reception. New York City at the time was home to young folk singers like Woody Guthrie and Pete Seeger.
Come all of you good workers, good news to you I'll tell of how the good old Union has...
Although North American roots or folk music was big in the 1940s, the Inca Taqui trio didn't fare as well as they hoped with their Andean folk music. But as the dawn of the 50s approached, another movement of music emerges called Exotica.
So you mentioned at the top of the show that Ima was the queen of Exotica, but what is Exotica?
I am glad you asked that. Exotica was this genre of music. Think mambo, tiki, lounge rhythms, combining things from like the South Pacific, the Afro-Caribbean rhythms. I think Nick Lemansky says it best in his book. He says Exotica becomes popular partially because the sounds inspired American fantasies of, quote, foreign lands and cultures, mysterious temple ruins, and forbidden rituals.
Ooh, forbidden rituals. I mean, it sounds fun, but also very stereotypical. I'm thinking like the tiki room in Disneyland.
Right.
These like cartoonish impressions of what foreign countries are like.
Exactly. And a lot of the time, the music was this mash of sounds and rhythms of what people thought the traditional music in those countries sounded like. So, quick story so you can grasp how far they would take these ideas of exoticism, right? One of the biggest names and pioneers of exotica is Les Baxter, who actually worked with Ima Sumac. Les Baxter writes the song that we're hearing, Quiet Village, in 1951. Martin Denny, another one of the exotica pioneers, re-records the song a few years later, and what's the primary difference? They added animal sounds.
And did it do better?
That version made it to number 4 on the Billboard Hot 100 chart in 1959.
So without animal sounds, it wasn't a hit. But with animal sounds, it was?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
So the name Exotica actually comes from Martin Denny's album Exotica that that track appeared on in 1957.
So I find this music very entertaining and super fun to listen to. But I also feel very weird about it. I mean, it draws on racist stereotypes of primarily indigenous people from other countries.
I can absolutely understand that, and I agree. But I think as a musician, if you take it out of the context of the stereotypes and for its musical value, the compositions and things are really beautifully done. And in the 50s, people ate up those kind of stereotypes.
Well, part of it was, I think, the time in America.
America goes to war. Men of the Army, Navy, and Marines reinforce the battlefronts on 6 continents.
We're talking 1950. The Second World War had just ended, and Americans were looking for something to entertain them.
So Nick argues in his book that the deadliness of World War II made Americans desire escape. It also allowed many people who had never traveled to travel all over the world. People who were stationed in places like Hawaii or the South Pacific came back home with different views of the world. The nation was prosperous, and air travel became a thing.
In 1953, 22 cities in the United States and 6 Caribbean countries joined the system.
So there was a tourism boom.
Right, yeah. Aircrafts were improved. You could fly farther and faster.
Which brings these magic islands as close as your next-door neighbor.
And there were more televisions, so you could bring images of these foreign lands to every household. You mentioned Disneyland. The first Disney park opens in 1955.
It announces the opening of Disneyland, the place. The people and eyes around the world are focused on these 160 acres here.
People discovered all these new places and cultures, places like Peru.
High in the Peruvian Andes, there's an ancient city called Machu Picchu.
Okay, but Machu Picchu was discovered way before that, 1911, right?
Yes, but the first hotel wasn't built until the 1940s.
So that was still a mysterious thing, and that kind of put Peru on the map. And then you have this singer.
Hi-ya!
Who comes from Peru, who sings like nobody's ever heard, and you've got a good gimmick.
So the time period was primed for someone like Ima Sumac to exist, and her unique voice and stage persona, coupled with her exotic look, leads to her big break. Out of the folkloric trio, she gets noticed and signs with Capitol Records in 1950. Here's Damon Devine again.
And I have the papers where they say, handwritten, mind you, with their letterhead at Capitol Records, we're not particularly interested in your husband or cousin. Because they came here as a trio. They said, but we are interested in Ima Sumac. Capitol Records had Frank Sinatra,
someone who'll walk.
Biggie Lee,
Peter, in the morning,
Ibn Nat King Cole, everybody.
Fun fact, Frank Sinatra opened for Ima Sumac in Japan.
The voice of America.
A star is born.
Ima Sumac.
Ima Sumac, célèbre chanteuse.
Ha paseado triunfal por los escenarios del mundo entero.
This is also the point where Capitol Records changes the spelling of her name. The name Ima was originally spelled I-M-M-A, and Capitol Records changes it to Y-M-A, because Y is considered more exotic. And it works.
She
she was just huge after that first record. It was nuts. It sold 100,000 copies in 1950 with very little promotion.
The album is called Voice of the Extabay and is released in September of 1950. By the end of that year, the album was number one on Variety's bestseller list. That album has never been out of print, which is one of the few albums through history that can claim that fact.
Dang!
The liner notes on this album are amazing. Listen to this. Prepare for an exotic musical experience, a voyage and discovery into a new land of sound, for you have never in your life heard anyone sing like Ima Sumac.
I mean, true statement, at least about the singing.
Yeah. But while Ima was getting rave reviews, her home country was not seduced by her song.
Coming up, the Inca princess's complicated relationship with Peru.
She didn't mention it. I guess that was her way of dealing with it, was not to mention Peru at all in those years.
Stay with us. No te vayas.
Hi there, I'm Felix Contreras, host of NPR Music's Alt Latino podcast. Every fall, many people around the country celebrate Latino Heritage Month. And while we like to say every month is a Heritage Month in our program, we still like to do something extra special. Intrigued? Listen and subscribe to Alt Latino from NPR and join the fun.
With producer Jeannie Montalvo.
Hola.
Hola, Jeannie. Okay, so we've been talking about Ima Sumac, who I've learned now had really an unreal voice. She was famous in the 1950s, but she was also a very complicated woman. She was known as the Inca Princess, the Queen of Exotica.
When we left off, Ima Sumac had just released her groundbreaking album, Voice of the Extabay, which to this day has never been out of print. On the liner notes of the album, there's a review from a Brazilian newspaper. It says, "The problems of our modern world are forgotten through the magnetism of this fabulous gift which comes to us, directly descended from Atahualpa, last of the Inca kings."
But was she actually the descendant of Inca royalty?
Very early on, Ima Sumac claimed she was directly descended from the last Inca king, Atahualpa. People tend to assume that was a U.S. marketing ploy, but she was using that before she ever set foot in New York City.
Okay, so still unclear if she is or is not an actual princess.
So in 1954, the peak of Ima's fame, she gets a big Hollywood break. She's given a role in The Secret of the Incas with none other than Charlton Heston, where she plays...
an Inca princess.
Good guess. But no, a sort of Inca high priestess.
Your daughter sang this song when she and the virgins of the temple were claimed by the sun.
People say it inspired the Indiana Jones film, Raiders of the Lost Ark, because it has this, like, American tour guide in this foreign land searching for lost treasure.
I think it's so funny that all of these, like, foreign films have that same, like, doo-doo-doo. Like, they thought, like, all countries outside of the U.S., their music
They all
went,
play pan flute. Yeah,
yeah, they're all like, doo-doo-doo. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And really, this one is no different. She's in the Andes, where they're searching for this lost gold trinket to make the Inca people great again.
Temple of the Sun. Only then will the people of the Inca be great again.
In the senior hearing, she's up in the mountains singing to a mass of indigenous people who are just staring at her and kind of swaying back and forth. Needless to say, this didn't go over well with Peruvians.
The way the local people, the Cusco people, were portrayed as brainless masses that worship mummies or worship princesses or objects, and that's pretty much the purpose of their lives. They just dance and sing and be beautiful or cute for foreigners.
That's Zoila Mendoza, a Peruvian anthropologist and a professor of Native American studies at UC Davis. She wrote about Ima Sumac and Inca identity. Zoila tells me that when Ima went on tour through Peru, there were protests and people threw tomatoes at her.
The one element that caused this big uproar and protests was the film. This has to do with stereotypes. And I think in the world, we deal with stereotypes all the time, and they can be very damaging.
I was waiting for the shoe to drop. People saw her as exoticizing, right? As probably stereotyping her own people.
Basically, yeah.
You know, local newspapers would criticize and recall how she was portraying a Peru and a Cusco that didn't exist, and for her own profit, for her own benefit, for her own fame.
And the movie sets off a spiral of criticisms that don't end for decades. Here's one comment from El Comercio, 1959, which states that on her tour through Arequipa, people, quote, whistled and hooted rejection because with her statements, this renegade Peruvian, Ima Sumac, had often made her countrymen look savage and primitive. She may be admired for her art, but her unworthy attitude as a Peruvian can never be forgiven, end quote.
I mean, I understand if you feel that your community is being made a cartoon out of. I understand why there was such a strong response.
True. And there are two other things that she's critiqued for. One, a year after the movie comes out, she becomes a U.S. citizen, which was seen as this betrayal to the Peruvian public by giving up her nationality. And two, people saw her as abandoning her folkloric roots and music to do exotica. They saw her as selling out. She was incorporating a lot of fusions with the Andean melodies and rhythms. But in folkloric circles, that wasn't received well.
So I think what happened was that she was kind of caught in between what her original public appreciated her own art and what was expected for her persona to be in a different context like the U.S.
In Peru, she was a folkloric musician. But in the U.S., she was an exotica musician and portraying this image of Peru that didn't exist. She couldn't please both. One of her biggest critiques comes from José María Arguedas, a Peruvian author who wrote a book, Nuestra Música Popular y Sus Intérpretes, published in 1977, Our Popular Music and Its Performers, in which he wrote, how can a woman who can't even speak a single word of Quechua, who grew up in Lima, the capital, and not in the mountains, sing traditional songs of the Andes? He says she has no national pride. And he goes on to say she's deformed the Andean music, making its most noble intents a pleasing show for the common people.
Every time I hear critiques like this, I'm like, wow, people think that what's happening now on Twitter is a new conversation, but we've been having these conversations about authenticity for such a long time.
Exactly. And, you know, to say Ima Sumac was a saint would be incorrect. She was also known to say that the only reason people knew Peru was because of her.
Not cool.
And in the 70s, she walked off a TV show in Peru because she got into an argument with the host.
Potentially cool.
Yeah.
But what was her response to all of this criticism?
Mainly radio silence. She hardly went to Peru. She went a few times when her family members were ill, but not on any major tours. In fact, in my research, I never came across her speaking publicly about this. At the same time she was receiving all this criticism, a lot was happening for her personally.
How do you feel about the charge?
Well, I feel very injured.
The same year the movie comes out, Ima and Moises, her husband, get into some trouble. Here's Nick Lemansky, who we'd heard from earlier.
When they came back from their European tour in 1954, she couldn't get back into New York Harbor because immigration said, you know, you can't come in. And it turns out the IRS said they owed thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars on all the recordings and all the tours they had done since 1946 to 1954.
When Capitol Records decided they wanted Ima as a solo act, Moises took a back seat managing, producing, and all of the finances. It takes Ima like 30 years to pay this IRS bill off.
When it comes to the paternity suit, was like a double slap in the face.
And in 1955, Ima's personal secretary files a paternity suit against Moises for her twin daughters.
Wait, what? Hold up.
I know. And while a lot of Ema's personal information in general is hard to find, that scandal was very public. She took camera crews and confronted the secretary.
Wow, that is some like TMZ moves.
I know.
Pre-TMZ.
There are other allegations of indiscretion, but really the public scandal and paternity suit were too much.
I really do think that a lot of the problems that she had had to do with the fact that she naively or whatever let Moises take care of everything.
They do finally get divorced in 1958. And despite that, she continues a work relationship for almost 10 years with Moises. After she fully separated professionally, she was left to manage her career on her own. In an interview, she said,
"You know, when you are in show business, this job is very hard and very difficult because you have to be almost perfect. In my case, for instance, you know, the critics all over the world, they wrote about Ema Suma so much. She has this, she has that. I'm not perfect, you know. So when I came to the stage, I had to be exactly why they describe Ema Suma, you know. It scared me so much. Then I have a very sacrificed life."
She became much more solitary and somewhat difficult to work with. She was known to stop concerts if she didn't agree with something.
"I want to give a good music to the audience. Will you turn to the sound now, please? This is terrible. It's too loud."
Ema Suma was this very unique and amazing figure. I would say a very strong woman for her time.
This is Zoila Mendoza again. She argues, along with other people I've interviewed, that Ema got a lot of unfair criticism because of her gender.
There was the fact that she was a woman, an environment that was dominated by male figures. So there could have been that, too, the fact that she was so harshly criticized. A lot of the voices that were in the newspapers, a lot of the artists that were criticizing her were men.
For example, the author who critiqued her so harshly for not speaking any Quechua, Arguedas, in that same long criticism, he tacks on a line at the end about her estranged husband, Moises, saying, "Thankfully, Moises Vivanco is with her, and he can save the day, he who can really know our true Andean music."
During her time, being a woman and famous must have been really, really hard. Again, in the U.S. was slightly different. I don't think a lot easier necessarily during that time, but easier than Peru. And, you know, we women in Peru, even though things are changing, are not always considered as valued or worth it or smart. It's always only because maybe you're a pretty face, maybe you make it.
By the time she started to work with Damon in the late 1990s, Peru wasn't something she spoke about. Here's Damon Devine again.
"She never mentioned it. I found this out going through her things that were left to me. It's a dress from Secret of the Incas. These were her good luck earrings, these gold fish."
Damon inherited Ema's estate.
"The newspaper headlines, the things she said to them, the things they said to her. She didn't mention it. I guess that was her way of dealing with it, was not to mention Peru at all in those years."
The 60s gives birth to rock and roll. And space travel replaces the allure of foreign lands.
"It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind."
People began to forget Ema Sumac. But Ema continued to tour and had a comeback. She recorded a rock album, Miracles, released in 1972, which would be her last studio album that still had the characteristic Ema vocalizations. Ema Sumac gave her last concert in 1997 at the Montreal Jazz Festival. She developed a sort of cult following in later years, became an icon for the LGBTQ community, and her music found its way into movies like The Big Lebowski.
"Hello, dude. Thanks for coming."
TV shows like Mad Men.
"I used to think I'd find a husband here."
Samples like The Black Eyed Peas.
"Coming with rhythms to make your head jerk."
And Robin Thicke. And even this Kahlua commercial.
"The everyday exotic. Kahlua."
Each new generation catches on to her. The goths and punks discovered her in the 80s when she had that really huge comeback. I think they identified that they were unusual and she was unusual, and there was a connection there, and she liked them as much as they liked her.
What they doing?
So we'd gone to some public function, a concert, and she was hungry, but she was very exhausted from people coming up to her all night. So she said, let's just go here. I see a bunch of young people there. They won't know anything. So we go in there and we step into the main dining area. And the moment we step in there, some young girl jumps up from the table and says the whole damn place, oh my God, it's Ima Sumac. And she says, ay caracho.
But what happened with her in Peru? Did she ever go back?
Bienvenida al Perú.
Well, 2 years before she passed away, Ima went to Peru to finally receive recognition.
He llorado un poco en el avión al llegar a mi país otra vez.
Es un personaje súper importante para nuestra historia musical, ¿no?
I'm very surprised. They're saying she's a very important character in our musical history. I'm shocked given how much they hated on her. Now she became an icon. What happened?
Well, that was Limber Lozano. He's a historian, but also the director of the program Sucedió en el Perú, which means it happened in Peru.
El Perú fue un poco, como podríamos decir, ingrato, tal vez, con Ima Sumac.
They did an episode on how Peru had a change of heart with Ima Sumac. In the early 2000s, a radio host, Miguel Molinari, started using his radio show to promote Ima Sumac and make a case for bringing her to Peru to give her recognition while she was still alive. So, I called Limber to talk about what changed for Peruvians. He says it was the debt they had. She hasn't been given the importance she should have. He says enough time has passed.
So enough time has passed, and now they start to see value in Ima Sumac. Why?
Well, Limber goes on to say that she was a product of her time.
Ima Sumac como un personaje producto de su tiempo, ¿no? De alguna manera, lo que ella vendía era una imagen exótica del Perú.
He says, yes, she did present an inauthentic image, an exotic view of Peru. But it's important to remember the norms of Hollywood at the time.
Los cánones de Hollywood, etc.
The limitations of who could succeed in Hollywood at the time. He says, you have to remember the context in which she lived.
En el contexto de la época que ella vivió.
Limber also says there is a saying in Peru.
Nadie es profeta en su tierra.
It's literally that no one is a prophet in their own land. Meaning, a lot of times people need to leave home to be heard. He says Ima Sumac isn't the only case. Cases like the great Peruvian composer and singer Chabuca Granda and Susana Vaca all have had greater followings outside of Peru. But things are changing. The country is different. They're reclaiming what's theirs. In 2006, Peru awards her La Orden del Sol, the highest award you can be given for extraordinary contributions, amongst a few other awards and accolades. Here you can hear her arriving into one of the government buildings, packed with people, and an orchestra playing El Cóndor Pasa, a song considered part of Peruvian national heritage, a song which even she herself covers in the 1970s. Here's Zoila Mendoza, our anthropologist we heard from earlier.
Those who have Andean background, before you die, there are very important things that you need to do that relate to your past. And so we go through the world leaving part of us wherever we go. In order to continue our travel after we die, we would have to go back to those places and retrace our steps. In fact, it's funny because it's, I think, opposite than the idea of the bucket list. The bucket list, like, you have to do things that you haven't done. But in Peru, people are always, in many ways, looking to the past in a positive way. You know, you have to recognize what came before you, what you did before, in order to move forward.
Déjame que te cuente limeño. Déjame que te diga la gloria.
It really seems like Ima's decades-long career came full circle when she retraced her steps.
Yeah, exactly. And Zoila actually has another connection to Ima Sumac. Her mother and Ima were friends when they were in school. And as part of Ima's journey, she visited Zoila's mother.
She went to my mother's house, and went to visit her and they hugged. And she said, you know, I wanted to give you a hug and kiss you like when we were girls. Sorry, I'm getting a little emotional here. And then she just left, and then she just passed.
Ima Sumac finally made peace with her home country. She never forgot Peru.
Me siento tan emocionada y agradecida por el pueblo peruano. Yo nunca he olvidado el Perú.
This episode was produced by Jeannie Montalvo and edited by Sofia Palizacar. The Latino USA team includes Fernanda Camarena, Miguel Macias, Antonia Serigido, Maggie Freeling, Janice Yamoka, and Alyssa Escarce. Fact-checking by Lila Chernev. Special thanks to Damon Devine. Our engineers are Stephanie Lebeau and Julia Caruso. Our production manager is Natalia Fidelholz. Our digital team includes Julio Ricardo Varela and Amanda Alcantara. Our New York Women's Foundation Ignite Fellow is Fernanda Uriegas. Our intern is Adriana Tapia. Our theme music was composed by Senia Rubinos. If you like the music you heard on this episode, stop by latinousa.org and check out our weekly Spotify playlist. I'm your host for today, Antonia Cerejido. Our executive producer is Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next time, and in the meantime, you can find us on social media. Adios!
Latino USA is made possible in part by the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. And the Heising Simons Foundation, unlocking knowledge, opportunity, and possibilities. More at hsfoundation.org.
Holder, faster, stronger, longer. That don't kill me. Okay.
It's been over 30 years since he starred as Richie Valens in the film La Bamba. My conversation with actor Lou Diamond Phillips. That's next time on Latino USA.